the UNCR in Microkelvin. And until about 5 years ago, it was very, very difficult to get below about that level. And this is R of 0.01. Okay. So we have a long way to go. This is a factor of 300 in temperature, or 10 to the fifth in power. And the question is, can we do that on the scale of 10 years from here to here? And I'm going to try to convince you that that may be reachable without a satellite on the scale of 5 to 10 years. Okay, so I'm not going to go through the theory at all, except to try to. This is a visualization which I find very helpful. So Eric Yvonne made this simulation. This is a path of the sky as observed with an instrument with a 40 arc minute beam, and you'll see in a moment why that's a useful number to visualize. And it's 30 degrees across, and you see the temperature and anisotropy in color, and the polarization shown as the pseudo-vectors. And this is the case where there are no tensor modes. And then I'm going to flip to a case which adds tensor modes at a level of R of 0.1, which is a pretty big signal. Okay. And I'll flip back and forth between those. And of course,
it's really detected at the center.
Right. But other than the lockers, your eye is drawn, of course, to the changing colors, and we all know that we can't use those. That's cheating, because they're degenerate with other parameters. So what we're trying to detect is the little shift in these lines here, and this is a scale of about 4 microcolor. And so the challenge is not only to have very, very high sensitivity, but to make a map of the polarization with such exquisite fidelity that we can do vectors on this side and get the right answer. And that's a big, big challenge. And to be honest, we've made more progress than I would have expected at this point. Okay. So here are the chasers, at least a partial list. This field has attracted, this particular narrow, ephemeral topic in this field has attracted an enormous amount of attention. I think it must be that CMB experimentalists as a class of people are drawn to chaotic quests. and just about everyone and his brother has figured out a way, one way or another, to go after this. WMAP and another experiment that I'm going to spend most of my time talking about, called ICIP, are taking data right now that are relevant to detecting the primordial beam. Quiet is being built. It's partially funded. It's funded through a first phase. And the Quiet team will tell you that they hope to be on the air sometime in 2008 in the Atacama Desert. ICIP 2 and SPUD, which I'll also talk about today, although the proposed still pending, is being built, and they hope to be on the air shortly thereafter. Of course, there is PLONK. And I'm not going to say anything about PLONK today. Not that I'm not a big fan of PLONK, but you can read all about PLONK. And then SPIDER is a Bloomberg project that Bart is going to talk about after me. And there are many others which are in various stages of development or vision or dreams. And this is just my guess at time scale. So it's not the very, very distant future that all except for the satellite expected is going on. So my attitude towards the field is we would make available an enormous amount of free energy if we could, as quickly as possible, just say whether or not there is any D-mode signal above the level of about 0.02 or so. Because if there's not, we can just go do something else. And right now, to be honest, there's a lot of talent being sucked out of this. And the question is, how do you most quickly kind of flush this out, right? And I'm going to lay the stage. I'm going to argue why the quickest path is to observe at 150 gigahertz, which is exactly what you heard Lyman say a few days ago, but which is not the impression you might get if you read the WMAP papers. And I'll try to explain that. And why you should focus on a small, clean patch of the sky, which is not particularly what you build a satellite to do. You can do that from the ground. Why you might want to use a small telescope, and by small I mean like 10 or 12 inch primary aperture, and all the advantages that accrue from that, and why you can get away with that. How are we going to get the sensitivity we need, and why one really, really good place to do this, for reasons you might not suspect, is the subfold. Now, every CMD result that has produced cosmology to date, no, I can't say that anymore, all the temperature measurements were able to be done without any significant correction for foregrounds. That is not something that anyone knew would be possible. We got really, really lucky, and it was one of the things that made progress in the field so rapid. It ain't going to be the case for the polarization, at least not for the D-modes. Lyman showed you this plot from WMAP, and I should point out here again is now only shown as R of 0.3, bigger than the signal is going to be, right? And here are the foregrounds at a frequency which WMAP concludes on average over the whole sky is near the minimum in the foregrounds. And you can look at that and say, why shouldn't we just give up right now? Because can you imagine trying to convince someone, let's say that the real signal of ours is down here somewhere, an order of magnitude below these foreground estimates. Can you imagine trying to convince someone that you've dug into foreground contamination, right, 10 times deeper into the foregrounds, right, and taken out a D-mode signal, and that your conclusion is, rather than the fact that you may have been off in your foregrounds interaction, you discovered evidence for inflation. Occam's razor says, forget it. Now, here's why the story is not so great. For the that 65 gigahertz is, in fact, correctly, the minimum foregrounds over some very large portion of the sky. And you need to observe a very large portion of the sky to observe this feature here. But there's another feature here that we know it will be in this signature. And to go after that feature, which is on an angular scale of a few degrees, you can get away with 2 or 3% of the sky. But it's still a big enough angular scale of a few degrees that you can get away at 150 gigahertz with a 10-inch aperture. I'll get back to you in a moment. The real reason for going to 150 gigahertz is the following. So here are two maps of the entire sky. This plot was created by Clem Price, who's part of the Price of Two-Split collaboration. And this is the estimate of what synchrotron emission would look like at 150 gigahertz, derived from the WMAP K-band data. And this is the estimate of what dust emission would look like at that same frequency, derived from the Pinkminer-Davis Lake model. The first thing you notice is there's a heck of a lot more contrast in dust emission than in synchrotron emission on the sky. That's not news to anyone. But then if you think about that, if there's more contrast in the dust, and if I do a sensible thing and restrict myself to a relatively clean region of the sky to get around foregrounds, that means in that clean region of the sky, the minimum or the best frequency to operate at is going to shift higher than the 65 gigahertz that's over the whole spectrum, because the synchrotron spectrum is falling as the best rising. And if you work out the details, go through all the details, we estimate that in this red patch, which is the cleanest region of the sky, according to this modeling, that the minimum has shifted all the way up to about 150 gigahertz. So if you want to just avoid foregrounds, if you want to take the same tactic that we did with temperature measurements and say, I'm going to use some frequencies where I don't have to deal with foregrounds at all, and I'll go as deep as I can that way, work at 150 gigahertz and stay in this patch. The red squares, by the way, so the size of the square, we laid down these squares all over the sky, and this is the only size patch of its kind that's as clean as this in terms of dust emissions. And then all the white things show, I'm sorry, all of these patches are as clean as this area in terms of dust emission, and all of these patches are as clean as this area in terms of synchrotron emission. So it's a pretty special part of the sky. Right. So that's why we work with the mirrors. If you go to 150 gigahertz in this particular patch in that red target region, we estimate that the total of synchrotron plus dust foregrounds is at about here. Okay. Now remember, at 65 gigahertz over the whole sky, the foregrounds were up here, above R.3. Now we think they're probably down at about 0.03 or so before you run into trouble. And that's a combination of dust plus synchrotron emission. And in addition, another foreground or source of confusion, if you will, of course, is the lensing signal. And if you take these two and you look at the target signal, that what you are admonished to do is to go as deep as you can at angular scales corresponding to L of about 70 or 80, angular scales of a few degrees, at 150 gigahertz in this target region. And then I'll explain what these sets of curves mean in a moment.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
What do we know about spinning dust at its frequencies?
The spinning dust signal should be very small at these frequencies. That's a problem for lower frequencies. So that's now, why do we use such a small aperture? Well, first of all, if you can make the measurement with a smaller telescope, why use a bigger telescope? The size, the micro background experiment, the size of aperture it needs is driven not by light gathering ability. These aren't light buckets. It's driven by the diffraction limited beam. Okay? And we're going to take advantage of the fact that this now, unlike the temperature anisotropy where we needed a 10 arc minute or 12 arc minute beam or whatever, we can now use a beam of a degree or so. Now, the advantages that you accrue are very great. First of all, it's cheaper. Right? Secondly, if your telescope is this big, that's the window. Right? You can cool the whole telescope to 4 Kelvin, which makes it mechanically and thermally very, very stable. When you put your instrument together back at Caltech or wherever, and you very, very carefully measure all the properties of the beam, one, the far field is 50 meters away inside the high bed, if they can put a far cup, you can fill the aperture with all kinds of calibrators. And most importantly, when you ship your instrument to the South Pole, it's already integrated with the telescope and fully tested. Right. You can also get much better suppression of side lobes. Here's a picture of this instrument installed at South Pole. Almost all instruments, experiments, as you'll see, have one of these big ground shields. And you saw there's a similar ground shield on the back. But we have, in addition, this black four-baffle that moves with the telescope. This is a microwave-absorbing material. And as you can see, even if you got over this ground shield, you can't see the telescope. You have to bounce several times off of that back. So those are some of the advantages of the small aperture. Now, why go to the South Pole? You would think of all the godforsaken hard to get to places, but it turns out it's not true. First of all, this target region, which is the uniquely best target region of the entire sky, is observable 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for 10 months of the year. For 2 months, the sun gets a little close. Right? In our first year of observing the South Pole, the first year that we commissioned, we obtained time on the target with the whole system working, which was in excess of 3,000 hours. You couldn't do that from any other site. The altitude at South Pole is actually over 10,000 feet. It's all ice, but it still counts. The sun is below the horizon for 6 months, which is very useful. It's an extremely stable, dry atmosphere. Now, the last two may not be obvious. Simple low-cost logistics and easy access to the telescope.
That's what someone else is paying for.
Well, exactly. The U.S. spends about $200 million a year to maintain this presence down there, and it is allegedly in order to do science. So they're happy to spend a few percent more to actually do the science. That's true. And let me just point out, you've heard some results from Paul recently. So this is what it looks like down there. This is taken from the place that we live, which is a few hundred meters walk to the telescope. You can sleep at this altitude comfortably. You can live very comfortably.
Then you can walk to the airport.
You can walk to the airport. That's an easy market. There's a basketball court. There's a greenhouse. It's really cushy down there. And guess what? All I need to do is get my people and cargo to LAX. And the US government pays for every other thing not on my grant. Everything. Power, food, rooms, all there.
You know you're being recorded here, Andrew?
Yes.
Any further?
This is actually, this is a fantastic place to work. And it's a joy to be down there. The weather's great. It's daylight coming over. So let me talk now very quickly about BICEP. I want to distinguish. I'm going to be talking about BICEP 1, which is what is in the field now, and then a future version of it, which has a larger collaboration. This is the group involved in BICEP 1. You can see kind of physically the size of the team and of the instrument, and that's before we shipped from Caltech. It's a very simple telescope. It has two polyethylene lenses. It's a telecentric design, so that it produces a fat and flat focal plane, which will be important, as you'll see. There's the aperture. We do not have one in BICEP 1, but we will in BICEP 2, if you have the option of putting a wave plate right up at the front aperture here, which is the ideal place to have it. This is a picture of what the focal plane currently looks like. It's instrumented with the same technology that will fly on Planck, one hopes, within a year or so. Polarization-sensitive bolometers on Planck. There are four pairs of detectors at each of four frequencies. In BICEP, there are 25 pairs of detectors at each of two frequencies. The instantaneous sensitivity of BICEP now in the field is not too different from what Planck will achieve on orbit. And in fact, since we can rack up 3,000 hours in a year, and we're already operating, and we're concentrating in that just a few percent of the sky, we've already gone deeper than Planck will go on that small part of the sky, albeit with lower angular resolution. But it's a very targeted experiment. This is getting lifted into our accommodations down there in almost 2 years ago. And just some more pictures quickly of what it looks like to install things down there. Now, this is our target region. It's another version of that red square that I showed you. And then we spend about 20% of our time off on these regions mapping the galaxy, but most of our time on this region. And what we're doing, this region is at about 55 or 60 degrees elevation, nicely from the South Pole. And we just scan back and forth. And our whole instrument can rotate around the war site. And every few hours we rotate it and make another map, etc. Okay. So here's some data. This is the FDS dust model of the plane of the galaxy over a big swath of sky. You can see this is RA of about 100 to 260 degrees or so. This is what's called the Planck sky model. This is a model of the sky which uses FDS and everything else we could lay our hands on to try to model what the polarized sky will look like. There's some polarization vectors here. And this is the actual data from BICEP in its first season, with about 10, probably representing about 10% of the time that we spent. And you can see, at first glance, that there's a very nice correspondence between those two. And then if you look in a little more detail, you'll see that there are some differences. The Planck sky model in FDS, see this little thing is very bright, and it's actually not so bright. But the bottom line here is, what's the amplitude of the polarized dust emission? And the amplitude of the polarized dust emission is very comparable. You have to be careful to be looking at the length of these lines and not the density of them. the length of these lines tends to be actually a little bigger than we're actually measuring. What we're actually measuring is very consistent with the WNEP number, about 3.5% refraction.
But the orientation is different on the left side.
Yep. Well, I believe this one.
So, because it's the nine model magnetic field, I assume.
To be honest, I haven't dug into the details. I didn't make the Planckstein model. But what we're doing now is we're using this data to make the Planckstein model better. We've also gone very deep or deeper in this red patch, and we've not detected any polarization yet, but we're close to hitting that 3.6% or so. So we should know that by the end of the year.
Eta point is what I need to know.
I'm sorry?
You mean eta point?
I mean, this is a polarization of the sky.
It's not eta, but just like
no, it's not. It's just the total polarization of the sky.
The electric field is
eta. I'm going to get to E and B. Okay. So this is our CMB target region. This is a density of coverage. This is WMAP data at 94 gigahertz, which has been scanned in the same way that our instrument works, so it's filtered the same way that our filter does. This is the actual data of, in temperature. If we size the frequency channels, you can see it compares very well to WMAP. We can actually calibrate our detector system on a daily basis by looking at our temperature versus
in the WCMB units.
Yeah, right. So these are CMB units. And we didn't, you know, the instrument's not designed to measure temperature. It's wide open to all kinds of atmospheric instability, but it does a good job of that. This is the jackknife when we do the frequency difference. This would show up instrumental effects as well as any foreground. We don't expect a foreground in the temperature map, just the temperature signals of the day. Then we can, and now I want to mention the fact, this CMB is plus or minus 150 microkelvin CMB. Thermodynamic. Now we jump to plus or minus 2 microkelvin thermodynamic. So you see that the sensitivity has gotten pretty good or better. And this is the bicep E mode, 100 plus 150, and the jackknife, 100 minus 150. And you don't have to squint too hard to see that there's signal in here. And that this, in fact, is consistent with noise at the level we would expect. And we're down at about 1 microkelvin per square degree on the scale. And then we can wince and say, all right, look at the B mode. And there's no significant signal yet in the B mode. So this is like the first gloss of looks like it's working. And I'm not going to show you any power spectrum.
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
Well, I'm sorry, technical term. This is a map where I take all my data at 100 and 150 gigahertz, two different frequencies, I sum them, co-adding them in proper thermodynamic CMB thermodynamic units. And I should see what are signals there. If I now take those same two data sets and I subtract them from one another, I should see only instrument noise if everything's working and there's no foregrounds. Right. So the fact that there's no signal apparent in this is good. The fact that there's no signal apparent in this means we have an upper limit. And I'm not going to say what that is yet. Except that there are no enormities. I mean, I think, well, in fact, I'll show you quantitatively where we think we're at right now. So this is a plot prepared by John Kovac. And this, the top panel is our raw sensitivity, microkelvin, RMS, on a 1 degree patch as a function of time from kind of now through about, you know, the end of 2011. And we first drew this a few years ago. This is when we put our proposal into NSF a few months ago, and we're about here now. And in fact, these X's are exactly where we are. So the noise is integrating down exactly as we would expect, and it looks like we're down at about 0.7 or 0.8 microkelvin per square degree now on the sky. And these various, this is a projection of how we'll do in the future. When we bring a new technology online, which I'll talk about in a moment, first at 150 and then at 100 gigahertz. We're also making some 220 gigahertz observations as we speak. Now, if you take that and then you convert it into a limit on tensor to scalar ratio, you get this. And if we just let bicep 1 run and run and run through the end of next year, we would get down to just below about 0.1. And right now, we should be at around 0.2
It's clear that they will continue to get better as the sewer plan or whatever.
There's every evidence so far that it should. Right? Now, I'll get to systematics in a moment. So one of the things that will limit you is here. So far, in this region, galactic foregrounds and lensing are not important. And they continue to be relatively unimportant down to a level of about 0.1. When we turn on a new machine, which we hope is in a year and a half, and we have more sensitivity, this is the raw instrument sensitivity now. This is including galactic foreground confusion, but not subtracting it. Yeah. Right? I'm sorry, that's not true. It's including galactic foreground confusion and beginning to subtract it. And then this is including the lensing signal, and we're not doing anything with the lensing because we don't have an algorithm for that yet.
What can you do? Could you read my for each L? Is this the
what we're doing here? Let me see. What we're doing is we're using all of the L bins that are useful to us. All right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. So basically, it's this. So that limit represents using this information. Most of the information is coming from these two L bins. So they're L of about 40 to 90.
So it's in principle where there is technological signal, not from lensing. In principle, you could see polarization from primary orientation waves, right?
Yes,
at that point.
That's so it's concentrated. And we will know it if everything will go very well by the middle of next year.
No.
But you show that
I said we'll finish acquiring data that should give us the sensitivity to get to these upper limits by the end of next year.
1.5 m² / 5 m² instead could be.
And then it will take us some time to analyze the data. But it's not a distant dream. Right? So this is what's real and what we can do now. Now, Bart's going to talk about, in a few minutes, what comes next. Bart's going to talk about the balloon form part of what comes next, and I'm going to try to briefly talk about the ground-based part of what comes next. We can't build a focal plane 10 times bigger than this. We just can't afford to do it. This is really heavy, and it takes a lot of money to build these beamforms. We need to have the microwave equivalent of a CCD. I don't know if Hector remembers, but I was in Stockholm some many years ago, like four or five years ago, and talking, jabbering about someday having something like this, and I think we have one now. The prime architects of this include Danny Bach, Phil Jones, and Chao-Lin Ho, Caltech and JPL, and without going into any detail because of the audience, this is what one pixel looks like now. It doesn't have any corrugated beads. It is a phased array antenna on a piece of silicon, and the key thing is all of the functionality of the pixel now is reduced to things you can microlithograph on a silicon wafer. You can just stamp them out. We detect the two orthogonal polarizations. We do it with a TES kilometer of the same sort that SCUBA app use, and in fact, Mark Halpern will be providing the electronics to read this out and Ken Herman, the squid box. And this is just to say that this is now much harder to do. It takes a lot more money. It takes a big team. It takes a lot of resources at JPL. It takes all these institutions. Right? And this is for the ground-based version, which we call BICEP 2 for lack of imagination. Compared, this is an actual beam map of the BICEP 1 beams on the sky at 100 and 150 gigahertz. And this is what a simulation of what the beams will look like when we populate the flat focal plane with these four tiles at 150 gigahertz. This is what BICEP 1 looks like now. We're going to replace it in its mount with this new device at 150 gigahertz. We hope in a year and a half. We're working hard to meet that deadline. And then after that, as you'll see, we turn into more and more frequencies. And so the mount that the Quad telescope just came off of will eventually be instrumented with up to six of these telescopes, all looking in the same direction. Importantly, each of them, the reason for having six separate telescopes, why not just build one bigger telescope? Each has a small aperture. You get all the benefits of that. And each is monochromatic. And if you want to build a really high-performance polarimeter, you don't want reflections in your optics and you want to be monochromatic, monochromatic. All right. There are many more details that I won't go into, but this is just to say that we do think about them. And it may be the case, so this column is the specs that we need on all these various things, like cross-polarization and differential full photometric beam and differential pointing, the things we've actually measured in BICEP 1. Most of these numbers are good enough already to operate the next generation machine and not be limited by systematics without a wave plate. But if we do put in a wave plate, it just eliminates the sensitivity from most of them. All right, so we've seen this already. So what if there is a goose? So among the things we'll need, because no one will believe a single experiment, which has been designed to be a very streamlined attack, right? We're going to need higher frequency coverage, and among other things, SPIDER will provide that. We'll need lower frequency coverage. FIAC will do a good job of that. This target region is also, thankfully, accessible from Atacama, not all the time, but most of the time. We'll need other experiments. We'll need higher angular resolution to get at the lensing signal. There's very, very definite plans in the works for SVT and ACT. And if any of you want job security, you can go to work on a future satellite. So I'll stop there and let Martin take a look.